Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Stephen the Warman Wright's Kickfighting Podcast Show. I'm your host, Stephen the Warman. You are listening to this podcast in one of two ways. Either you are at my blog, which is lorddaul.podbean.com. I upload a show to it once a week, once every other week, twice a week. Just kind of depends on how much kickboxing action there is. Or you are at the most efficient way of getting my show, which is at the at the iTunes search engine, which is LORDDAUL, or enter Warman Kickfighting Show into their search engine and my show pops right up. So today, and this is actually the second time I'm doing this, I was doing it a little bit earlier and then I lost a lot of my footage. No worries, I could be more efficient now. Today is the second time that I do this podcast. I am excited because I'm going to go into my summer series to start today. My goal was to tell you guys about the elite kickboxers and kickboxing rivalries in the sport. And the first time I was doing this, it was getting a little long, so this is a better way. This round two is a better way for me to be more efficient. But I do think you'll have fun with it. I'm going to go ahead and tell you guys stories to why I think the rivalries are great, why I think you'll enjoy them. But the biggest thing is, number one, this is the most important thing. This is my list. So if you want an official list, it's going to have to be done somewhere else. I just got simple criteria for it, but I want you guys to first and foremost understand this is my list. Also, understand that this is going to be from 1990 to today. I tried to go a little bit before it, but I just didn't find enough footage to, you know, watch the fights and give me a better breakdown of how much the rivalry meant. So please forgive me for those people who are like diehards. I was, you know, waiting to hear about, you know, super kick something versus this. Please forgive me. I'm trying to go from 90 up to today. One more thing. And this is another one that I know people are going to jump at me about. Please forgive me for one of my criteria is both had to have won at some period of time. And what I mean by that is there are some good rivalries where one person won both fights, but that doesn't work for me rivalry-wise. It means that you sold the fight well and you kind of, you know, got me behind in terms of the entertainment factor of it. You sold the fight well. You got me into it. But if you didn't win one of the fights in the series, then I'm going to have to step back and say, all right, this isn't going to work out for me. I need fights where at some period of time, both people won. So that's one of the main criteria. And then also just realize that I've got something for the stadium people because it's a lot tougher for stadiums to have rivalries because they fight so much. The elite fight so often. If a fight's closer, they usually call for that fight again, you know, like a month later, 2 months later. So I don't want to disrespect them. I've got something for my stadium people. I'll even tell you what one of my summer series is on. It's on the biggest win by ties against Westerners. And I think that it's one of those things where it's like, oh, you know, that's, you'll go down the list and you'll be like, okay, that makes a lot of sense to me. So I think we'll have a lot of fun with this list. I think that it's going to have some things for people to go down memory lane. And the second time of me doing it helps me be more efficient because that last show, I'm telling you, it was looking like it was going to go to like 2 hours. So this is my I can look at the time already and see that I'm already better off. So first of all, I'm going to go ahead and throw you 21. Why am I throwing you 21? Because I had a list of 20 originally, and then I decided to add one more because I just thought that it was just good enough to make the list. So go ahead and, oh, one more thing. These are not numbered, so just enjoy them as they are. Enjoy these kickboxing rivalries. They are not numbered. I do not have a, you know, this is not 21 all the way down to the number one rivalry of all time. I want you to just enjoy the list. Just enjoy it. Go down memory lane. And for those of you who don't even know what I'm talking about or who've been watching the podcast and you've only been paying attention to the newer kickboxing, this is a great opportunity for you guys to go down memory lane the last couple, you know, 26 years of kickboxing and see what you come across. I really do think you'll have a lot of fun with it. I think that there'll be fights that you maybe didn't know about that you really enjoy when you rewatch them or you watch them for the first time. So let's go ahead and jump right into it. First things first. Badr Hari versus Stefan Leko. The reason why this fight's important is because once upon a time, Badr Hari was this up-and-coming killer in Holland. And this guy he had a wiry frame. He's probably fighting at heavyweight, probably mostly about 86, 88 kgs is probably what he weighed. He was, you know, thin guy, but he had two things that can't be taught. Number one, he had KO pop in his hands, and he had killer instincts. Something about him being in there thought the other guy had to go. Like, nothing in him was like, all right, you know what? This guy's pretty tough. Let's go ahead and go to a decision. He tried to get you out of there. If he could get you out of there, no problem. But he tried to get you out of there. And that's very important. There are some people who go their whole career, and they never have that. They never try to get you out of there. And there are some people, I'd say the majority of the sport, didn't have KO pop. Even if you get a lot of KOs, it doesn't necessarily mean you have KO pop. I can watch a fight and tell if somebody has, you know, 30 of, you know, their 34 fights of, you know, are ending KO, and then I watch their fight, and they'll tell me real quick if they have KO pop or not. Sometimes you can just get the KO by overwhelming people. But he really did have that get you out of there pop. And both, you know, his hands and, you know, clearly you can do it with kicks and so on or whatever. But really, KO pop is something that people refer to someone's hands. That's usually what they're talking about, and that's what I'm talking about today. So this young up-and-coming kid, he's 19 years old. He does this interview for, I believe it's called, I can't remember what it was called. It was online, but basically he's talking. He's 19 years old, and he's looking at the camera, and he's saying, hey, you know, I think I'm going to be the next big star. By the time I'm 24, 5 years from that date, he was like, oh, by that, I'll for sure, at minimum, have 2 K1 World Grand Prix. Believed in himself. He was this up-and-coming kid. Enter Stefan Leko. Stefan Leko was a veteran. He had fought in K1 for a while. He got to the semifinals in the World Grand Prix before. He was just the guy who they thought would be a great first step because, you know, he'd gotten KOs before, but really he didn't, you know, have that, you know, destroyer type of KOs before, you know, like outside of the Peter Arts one. That still happened later in the fight after there were some wear to him. But Stefan Leko was going to be the guy that they thought was a good matchup. Going into it, there's all this talk, there's all this trash talk, weigh-ins going crazy, Badahari's, you know, showing the Badahari, and then the fight happens, and then, you know, less than a minute into a fight, spinning back kick lands to the liver, drops Badahari, he is down, and Stefan Leko wins. Crowd goes crazy just because, you know, everybody likes seeing something cool. And Stefan Leko, this shows how thick the animosity got. He reached over, he looked over him, and he spit on him after he'd fallen on the ground. Like, that's how heated things had gotten before the press conference. After that, things had calmed down a little bit. They put an interview on, or they gave Stefan Leko an interview, and he said, hey, Stefan, what are your thoughts on the fights, that kind of deal. Stefan said, hey, he's just a young up-and-coming kid that kind of needs to learn. He said, when I was 20 years old, I went against Ernesto Hoops, and that was a big thing that was a big learning curve for me. Back then, that's how they did things. Things are a little bit different now. But back then, from, I'd say, 95 to 2005, if you were an elite up-and-coming prospect, you probably dominated your country. So you probably had some world title from your country. It's like John Wayne Parr said it once. He said, if you want to be a world champion, you just got to fight the guy from the state over, because the guy over the state over probably has a world championship. But the first thing you want to do is you want to dominate your country. After you dominate your country, then you want to step up fight against a guy who's got like a K-1 name or an international name. And you usually get that fight, you know, if you got into the sport in kickboxing, you got into it at 15 years old, you usually got that fight, that huge international fight when you're 20. So that's how it happened for him. That's how it happened for Hari. Flash forward, 4 or 5 months, same year, I'm pretty sure. And we've got a rematch between these two guys. Stefan Leko, his big return to kickboxing after he'd had a gap away, if I'm remembering correctly. He gets the back into the K1 ring, and here comes Badahari. First introduction to the Japanese audience. He usually wears, you know, some sort of sporting jersey, like, you know, like Kobe Bryant jersey, something like that, whatever. But the main thing that you would remember from that walkout is, number one, how long it was. It was the longest walkout ever. And during that walkout, he's like rapping along to the lyrics, and he's like going to every fan, and he's slowly going. It's the slowest walkout ever. And he finally gets in there, and what's forgotten before the KO, it was a pretty entertaining kickboxing match. Pretty good back and forth. Pretty good exchanges, pretty good combination of kick flow. Pretty entertaining. Then all of a sudden, boom, spinning heel kick, this time to the jaw, and this time from Badahari. Badahari scores a big-time KO. KO drops Leko. Leko's in bad shape. Like Leko went down, he was in like the fetal position, and then Hari actually helped him up too. He was in bad shape. It's probably one of the most brutal knockouts I've ever seen. Mike Chiavello always says, as a commentator, it's the most brutal KO he'd ever seen. It's tough. What that KO meant was, this next generation kid, this new young up-and-coming kid who's got all these tools, he just went out there and beat one of the veteran guys in K1. He's got a style about him. He's got a swag about him. Like, people want to see this guy. And then it just went on from after that. Like, next thing you know, he's gets into the thing with Peter Graham, or he gets the Rolling Thunder, hits him. But the press conference stuff, that came, you know, more stuff behind the scenes, more stuff leading up to the fight. Like, he just, he became the character Bader Hari. But I think the thing that added to it was the fact that he had that skill set. It was the fact that he had that KO pop, and it was the fact that he had that KO. That KO was huge. So that's 21 on the list. Going to go ahead and go into my first rivalry series of the 20, Peter Art versus Semi Schilt. So this is the original 20 that I had down before I just decided to up and add the Lekko versus Bader Hari fight. So they fought five times, which just shows that's how kickboxing gets down. You know, we fight all the time. I really heard it said really well the other night. I'm watching Lion Fight, and Mike Chevelle is talking about, he interviewed Sam Greco. And he asked Sam Greco, how is it that you can get up and fight, you know, the same guy so much? Because Sam Greco fought from LeBanner a lot, you know, Ernesto Hoos, Peter Arce. He's fighting a lot of these guys a lot, like at that generation, at the top, those guys fought each other all the time. And he said, it's kind of like tennis. In tennis, you just see a lot of names at the top, so you expect to see them every year. And I was like, that's the perfect analogy. I've never heard of a better analogy than that. In terms of elite people fighting elite people on a regular basis because of the tournaments that they put into place and because of the fact that they keep winning and they keep staying at the top, that's the best example that I've ever seen. In that example, Peter Arce versus Semi Schilt was a five times. They met five times, which is just awesome. And the first time they met, Peter Arce was able to get a decision victory, if I remember correctly. I can't remember the location, but he's able to get a decision victory over Semi Schilt. Peter Arce had figured out what a lot of other fighters hadn't figured out, plus he had the link to take advantage of it. He figured out that Semi Schilt was very talented, but Semi Schilt didn't handle punches well. As you can imagine, he's not used to seeing them. He's tall, you know, he's like 7 feet tall, and he's used to just getting away with holding his hands out, keeping people away with his teeps and his body kicks, and just kind of playing out of range. If they throw, he just leans and he's out of the way. So Peter realized if you keep throwing, or if you can get past that initial jab, you can get the distance, you can score big overhands, and you can score offense. The goal is, of course, you have to figure out how to do this without getting stopped. Because other people, Ray Seffel, was able to score shots and get past it, and he was able to drop Semi. But when they got up, he ended up getting dropped in the next round because he ran into a jab. It just shows what that length does. So Peter Arce was able to close the distance, was able to score effective offense, and he's able to get two victories out of four. The other two fights that he loses, Semi Schilt is able to keep the range, able to score from a distance, able to score that teep, and one time Arce goes down by injury. And this is at a time where Semi Schilt is really making his name. He is the best kickboxer in the world at this time. People are going to hate it because, you know, he was taller, he didn't get into exchanges, he didn't have that look, that aura, he didn't have what people loved about the Japanese product, the Japanese kickboxing product. He didn't get into exchanges. That ain't got nothing to do with Semi Schilt. Semi Schilt was a winner, and he's one of the great kickboxers of all time, and if anybody tells you different, they are lying to you. They are not just lying to you, they're wrong. They don't like the answer. I'd say that's probably the main separation. I'd say they don't like the answer. Semi Schilt was great, and this is at a time where he was developing his greatness. So in these two fights, he was able to score at a distance. The teep was dangerous. He was able to get the decision and won. I think he won the K-1 World Grand Prix by beating Peter Arce by injury in the second one. And shout out to Peter Arce in that second fight. It's got to be mentioned. The backstage footage is great on that because Peter Arce was reserved. He came in, I believe he beat Teixeira in the undercard, if I remember correctly. I'm not 100% sure, but I think he beat him in the undercard, and then all of a sudden he gets called onto the main card, and then he stops Globe Fatoza, and then after he stops Fatoza, he meets Semi in the final, and he loses by injury. But it just showed why he became Mr. K-1. Just, I'm there, I'm here, and it's really cool because it shows like the Japanese, the owner at the time, his name eludes me, but he's sitting there talking to some people, and he's like, Peter, you know, and then all of a sudden they go to Peter, and Peter just happened to be standing there with his gear, hat on, with his, you know, lumberjack flannel on. He's just sitting there just waiting to see if he's going to be used. If he's not going to be used, let him go back and chill. He gets called in due to injury, and he's into the tournament, and he doesn't win it. But just the fact that he was called in and he goes out there and he brings that heat, that's why they love him. 2-2 after, four fights. And then we go to the fight where I truly believe the last time Peter Arts, a great fighter, had a great performance was against Simi Silk. And I want to say the 2010 K-1 World Grand Prix, the same one that Alistair Overeem won. In that tournament, I mean this sincerely, Peter Arts just... He just, I'm going to go all in. Like, he was fortunate enough to have Mighty Mo in the first fight. And I say fortunate just because he was able to get the kicks going early, stayed away from the big right hand, and he scored two downs. Fortunate because that fight wasn't a drag-out long fight. Fortunate because that fight brought him a big-time victory very, very quick in a tournament. Because you want to win quick, tournament-wise, he got that win. And then he had everything, all the energy he needed to go after Semi full. And the very first exchange, they touch gloves, he's all up in his face. Like throwing over the top, he landed kick here and there. But mainly he did with the boxing, and he's able to get a majority decision win. What I thought was clear. I thought he clearly won two of the rounds. You could call that other one even if you want, but I thought it was clear. But it was the last time he touched greatness, and he won. At late in his career, he wasn't even in his prime. He was the unbeatable Peter Arts in the 90s, for him to reach that later in his career, winning record over the elite kickboxer of that day is one of the elite performances that I'll always remember. Now Peter Arts, he still fights, he's older. People talk about how they want him to retire, and it's always tough to walk away. But shout out to, Peter Arts for putting on that one performance despite what's happening now, what's happened in his glory run. Right now he can't even train. He can't even train for fights because he's so injured. So he just hits the pads sometimes, and then he just goes off of his kickboxing experience when he gets in there and he takes these fights. So one of them, he just went to do some wrestling match and he took an MMA fight, just taking it. That's who Peter Arts is. But shout out to Semi Silt, who was the great kickboxer of that generation. He got two wins over Peter, but Peter got three. So shout out to Peter. Next rivalry I'm going to talk about, let's go ahead and stay with the Peter Arts theme. Peter Arts versus Ernesto Hoost. Arts, it's now I've got written down four fights, but I know there were five, and there may have been more. I think the first time they met, Ernesto Hoost won by low kicks, and I believe they're wearing pants in this, and I believe it did happen in the 80s. But when it happened after that, we got two early decisions by Ernesto Hoost, and then we got two decisions by Peter Arts. I think he won the third and fourth installment of that, of the K-1 run, and I think Hoost won one and two. The reason why I bring up this rivalry is because these guys weren't just fighting each other at this time. They're fighting the era. They're fighting to decide who is the great kickboxer, who is time going to remember. At this time, both won three K-1 World Grand Prix in the 90s, if I'm remembering correctly. I could be off. Hoost could have won 2000. I know he won 2002. Hoost could have won 2000. But at this time, that's what they're competing for. And Arts, in the beginning, there was a period of time where he was known as the slogan that they decided to advertise with was, who can stop Peter Arts? How awesome is that? You know you're the elite kickboxer if that's the message they're coming out with. So Arts goes out there and he gets 3-4. And I think 3 was got him a K-1 World Grand Prix, got him one of his K-1 World Grand Prix. So they sit there 2-2 as far as their K-1 run goes. And then there's a big gap before they fight again. And then, and one of the craziest events ever, we got Bob Sapp is scheduled to fight Ernesto Hoost. And I don't know if it's money. I don't know what the case was. At that time, I'm not going to lie, I used to defend everything about Bob Sapp. I was like, hey, man, this guy's trying for America. He used to play for the Vikings. It's an American football team. I used to defend him. But then this happened. I was like, man, it's going to be tough to defend. I don't know what he did. And people don't know if it was money or whatever it was, or if maybe he just started thinking like in a Buster Douglas kind of way. Buster Douglas got that win over Tyson, and they tried to make that fight happen again, and Buster's like, that's my moment in history. I'm not going to go ahead and erase it by competing again. And it never happened. They never got that rematch done. In that way, I'm wondering if whether it was finances or whether it was this idea that Bob Sapp got those two victories over Ernesto Hoos, those clubbing victories where he, you know, I mean, there were illegal shots in there and so on. No matter what, two W's by stoppage over Ernesto Hoos. He's got those in his resume. And I wonder if it just, the night, the culmination of it, I wonder if he's like, I'm going to lose this one, you know? And I wonder if he was like, this is the one that I don't want to lose. Which is weird because people jump on him because the end of his career was just him traveling the world and taking a few shots and then taking a knee. It's weird, but this night he decided, for whatever reason, he wasn't going to fight. So, all of a sudden, Ernesto Hoos has no fight. What happens? Peter Arts, who's already a few drinks in, sitting there chilling, he hears about this and he goes, I'll fight Ernesto Hoos. Because he's Mr. K1. Because he's the one that they love. That's why he's the man. So, we're in Amsterdam. He's going to get... as he said, he goes, I had to save the gala. Earlier that night, Semi Schilt had already fought Mark Hunt. And I think he won by spinning back. I think it was Mark Hunt. It could have been Lloyd Van Damme's. But he had already won earlier on that card. Then after he's done, Peter Arts borrows his shorts to go out there and fight. Now, again, he loses the fight. He wasn't prepared. They are both older. It didn't look. If you were to look at their bodies, just it was one of the biggest things that told you these guys are kind of past it. And still, Arts was able to beat Semi Schilt after all this. But they're a little bit past it. Their bodies are a little bit different. Both sporting some guts. And Arts goes out there and loses, but it's one of those things where you look at it and you go, that's why you're the man, Arts, and that's why you're the man, Hoos. Hoos could have just been like, all right, I'm just going to take a seat somewhere, chill with my family, watch the show. He goes, I want to compete. Arts is like, I'll compete with you. And it's just a great moment in kickboxing. I give both guys credit. It's why I love them. It's why I love the sport. It's just, and go ahead, people who are wondering, go look for that match, Peter Arts versus Ernesto Hoos in the Amsterdam Arena, and look at how big these shorts are. They look like clown shorts sitting on Arts because they were on Semi. But he went out there and competed. He, as he put in his own words, I had to save the gala. We can't not have a fight on the card after people paid. Shout out to Peter Arts. Next fight I'm going to talk about, next rivalry I'm going to talk about, is the fights between Masato and Takayuki Kohiriyamaki, which is one of the great battles in Japan between two Japanese athletes. I'll go ahead and spell that out for you for those who are wondering. Takayuki and then Kohiriyamaki. So Masato is this guy who's got it all. The girls love him. He's got all the tools. Comes out there, wins by blowout. Like, people think he's going to be the next big thing in kickboxing. Then early in his career, he runs into Takayuki Kohiriyamaki, and he gets smashed. This is, go ahead and look it up if you want to. This is a, especially when you see what Masato became. And I mean, he's one of the elite kickboxers of his era. Despite him turning into one of the elite of his era, he still ran into Kohiriyamaki and got smashed. Not even close, smashed. Smashed within like a minute and a half of the first round, smashed. Absolutely ran over. Like to the point where like he turns away as he's getting smashed and Kohiriyamaki is giving it to him. Then we go ahead and flash forward a few, I don't want to say 4 or 5 years. The idea of K1 pops up. Masato has been, you know, he's been winning like crazy on the, you know, in Japan, and they're bringing international competition in. He's beating them too. Then Masato, the idea, if you wonder why K1 Max existed, the, Extreme Max, championships, the middleweight division, it was birthed off of Masato. It's birthed off of him who, like I said before, they started to use him in super fights. And they started to use him in super fights in the K1 heavyweight brand. So all of a sudden, K1's got their heavyweights. And then here and there, they're going to go ahead and throw this fight in there with Masato. Why? Because Masato's a draw. People love him. Let's introduce him to a bigger audience because back then, they had huge audiences for K1. And Masato is one of the guys that you want to pay attention to. He's getting wins on those cards. And then they put together this idea of Max. And I think they first started with a Japan tournament, then they have a big, international tournament. In the Japan tournament, they meet again. Masato is going to go against Kohiriyamaki, and this time, the low kicks, the boxing, He's the better fighter. He's the better fighter this time around. Masato gets the W. And I know it means a lot to him because he goes on to win that tournament. And then, of course, he won two K1 World Math Grand Prix tournaments. But adding to it, Kohei Maki, he continuously fought in the Japan tournament. It was like his tournament to win. And he loved it, and he celebrated it like he'd won the, you know, both the American and Japanese World Series of Baseball. He celebrated like crazy when he won those tournaments, whereas Masato moved on, and Masato would just take on a good super fight here and there just to keep himself active. After some years, he didn't take on good super fights. He took on boxers, but like, he still had the Vince Phillips super fight, which wasn't great, but man, Masato, back in the day, I'm telling you, he was the man. And when Kohei Maki lost this fight, it evened the series up at one apiece. And you don't know if they're ever going to meet again because Masato keeps doing work. He keeps getting further into the tournament field. Whereas Kohei Maki, he could get to the semifinals sometimes, but then he had the fight with Bakao where he got smashed. And you know, he had just run-ins with guys where he just, you could see he was overmatched. And when he was overmatched, it looked like his effort wasn't there. 2006 K1 Max World Grand Prix, first round of that tournament field, you get Kohei Maki versus Masato again. And this time, and you're going to hear this phrase a lot, they're competing for the championship of each other. That was a phrase that is used when Joe Frazier fought Muhammad Ali in the Thrill in Manila. I am not comparing this fight to that fight. I'm just saying the term, they are fighting for the heavyweight championship of each other, means that history is going to look back and they're going to say, oh, 2-1 in favor of this guy. This guy's the winner. And that's what happened in, you know, the Thrill of Manila. And that's what's happening right here. Kohei Maki, you know, skilled. He was game. He tried. Masato was better. Masato better with the boxing, better with his low kick work, better with his combination work. He was just the better fighter. So when you look at this era of fighter, and he would have used it. Kohei Maki would have used it, no questions asked. If he had won these two fights, I don't care what they thought of that pretty boy. I beat him. No questions asked, he would have been the guy to really, really battle that information. So we'll see what happens. You know, with Kohei Maki, who tried to come back, but it didn't work out. Masato just had a comeback fight earlier this year, and in that comeback fight, it was an exhibition. It was the highest rated thing for combat sports that weekend. So credit due there. Him and Kid Yamamoto, but Masato won the championship of those two, and I think it was important for Masato to do it, even if he didn't say it out loud, even if he knew he had K1 World Grand Prix to look back on. I think it's important to him that he beat Kohei Maki, the guy who just smashed him when he first got started. Next fight I'm going to talk about, the next fight series I'm going to talk about, and my rivalry series, is Andy Hoog versus Mike Bernardo. So for those, I think these two, for those who are listening to it, as probably the series that people are most excited of, most excited to hear about. So it was 2-2, with Bernardo winning the first two and Hoog winning the second two. But Andy Hoog came out in a time where, first of all, he didn't have a proper mouthpiece, sometimes didn't have a mouthpiece, so he didn't know how to bite down an exchange. And this needs to be said, if I meet somebody and they said, hey, I did karate for 3 years, I respect them as a martial artist, no matter what. If someone says, I did Kyokushin karate, I think that they are one of the hardest people on the planet. That's just me. It's such a hard discipline. It's one of the hardest forms of karate. It is. They are hardcore. And Andy Hoog came from that. But because he came from that, he was limited in certain areas. Those guys don't punch to the face. They don't punch to the head. They can kick to the head. They can knee to the head. But everything they do is punches to the chest or to the body. Everything in the torso is good. And low kicks. Low kicks, low kicks, low kicks. And then the opportunity for something spinning, something jumping opens up. But the main thing they do is they are a combat sport with a lot of low kicks and a lot of punches to the chest. And Andy Hoog, who had developed a name in Japan, he gets the opportunity, and he's had mixed results in the beginning. He wasn't that good. When he passed away, Peter Art said it good. He said he wasn't that good in the beginning, and he got better. And Andy Hoog, when he wasn't that good, when he was trying to figure out the sport, he had some baffling losses. But when he lost to Mike Bernardo, not only were they weren't so much baffling losses, they are beatdowns. Because Mike Bernardo was just throwing that heat. And in one of the fights, he drops him 3 times in a round. Bernardo is just out there killing him. 2 fights in. We get to fight number 3. We get to the final of the K-1 World Grand Prix. Again, this highlight is sullied a little bit because most people, I guess if you're an MMA fan, you listen to like a Joe Rogan or something like that. The main thing you'll notice with Joe is Joe will usually comment anytime somebody does a backspinning heel kick to the leg, he'll always say, Andy Hook stopped the guy with that. What he doesn't say is Mike Bernardo fought a tournament and his leg was hurt before he got to that moment. Like, so he had received low kick damage before he got to that moment. He goes out there with the low kick damage, and then he tries to put on a performance, and he actually takes a down to low kicks before the spinning hook kick lands. Then, in one of the most poetic moments of all of kickboxing, he comes out trying to protect that leg. He is in a, you know, a southpaw stance, and he's like doing like these repeated teeps with his right leg, and then because, you know, Hook feels no damage whatsoever, he does this, you know, no threat of them whatsoever. He does a spinning hook kick, lands perfect, he scores a down, wins the K-1 World Grand Prix. You just don't get more poetic than that. It's one of the great moments in kickboxing history. It's one of the top 5 moments in kickboxing history. It is a special, special stoppage. After that, Hook goes on to win a 5-round decision, and it just kind of shows, hey, early on you got me. Early on, you beat me. But after that spinning low kick, things changed. I figured you out. I figured out this sport. He beat a lot of guys. When they went to, I want to say Switzerland. That's where Hook's from. It's Switzerland or Sweden. I think it's Switzerland. I'm going to drive myself crazy if I don't remember that. But as I rack my brain on this, I'm pretty sure that, you know, Andy Hook was from Switzerland. And yes, Blue-Eyed Samurai from Switzerland. Thank you. I would have hated myself forever. I just looked it up. All right. So he's from Switzerland, and I remember he had his last match or his retirement match from fighting in Switzerland, and they had a K-1 event there, had a lot of people and so on or whatever. But the main reason why I remember it is he fought Peter Arce at that event, and he won it. And I go, he just fought elite guys down the road. He could have picked some bum guys to fight at his home turf. But he had figured out the sport by the end of it. So shout out to Andy Hook, who went on to be a great. Mike Bernardo, of course, was, you know, I talked about him all the time. He's one of my first guys that I really loved when I researched the sport. Broke my heart when, I found out that, you know, through depression and through the pains of the sport. They said that, when I did the interview with Virgil Colacuto, he said that he had struggled with demons even, while he was a fighter. So he had been, fighting them for a while. So it broke my heart when he took his own life. But this rivalry stands in the history of this sport. It really was great. Next fight I'm going to talk about is Bukau versus Andy Sauer. Bukau, of course, is a guy who, there was a documentary, and the documentary is still out, so you can look it up. But the documentary was following the 3 favorites for the K-1 Max that year. And the 3 favorites were Bukau, who was the reigning champion, John Wayne Parr, and Masato. So those are the 3. So they're following these guys. They're following, John Wayne Parr. He's in Australia. He's still fighting full rules Muay Thai. And shows him at the house with Jazzy. And who's, so weird because Jazzy's like, all grown up now. She's, like 15, 16 years old. So it's weird that, thanks to him and him posting pictures throughout the years, and of course, his wife Angela Parr being a fighter too, we pretty much got to watch her grow up on social media. But like, he was in a documentary with his family and them, and then they show Bukau, who's in Thailand training hard. He's the reigning champion. He's coming off, that huge year. And then they show Masato. Masato, of course, is in Japan. He's busy with his schedule. He's all over the place. With media and so on, whatever. The tournament's all set up for one of these 3 to win. Arguably, you could, debate what could have happened there, but Kraus beats John Wayne Parr in the first round. Masato wins over Zambides, but then gets injured. And when that happens, an unknown guy, known to the kickboxing community, because of course he fought in shootboxing, that's when Andy Sauer enters the field. He enters the field, he wins a semifinal match, they compete in the finals, and they, it's a decent scrap, but They go to an extra, and in the extra, K1 will all, you know, they always lean towards the boxing more than they lean towards the kicks. Bacall did a lot of body kicks, did a lot of movement, Sauer threw boxing, didn't really land a lot, landed maybe one significant shot in the round. Despite that, they preferred that he was trying with boxing, and they gave him the win. So the first time these two meet, Sauer gets the win. Next year is probably one of the great years in all of K1 Max history. It goes into the event, all of a sudden you hear they're going to really lock down on the Bacall rules, what we called them on the fight forums. And basically all they're doing at that time is they're saying, hey, no clinch, we're really going to judge it harshly this time. And I remember they asked Masato about it. Masato was like, hey, man, this is really going to hurt guys like Bacall. Because we all knew who the rule was for. The rule was for Bacall. So Bacall goes out there with a very simple game plan of 1-2s and 3-2s. And he's able to really hurt a lot of guys. So it goes out there, and this is one of the epic K1 World Grand Prix. You know, we've got Artur Kashinko. He loses, he wins on the undercard. It's his debut to the brand, to the K1 brand. We've got a tournament field where I believe there was like a down in almost every fight except for one. But like our KO, it was just an awesome tournament. In that tournament field, Bacall, who runs through Yoshi Rosado, does drops Gago Drago, and goes to the final. He meets Andy Sauer. Andy Sauer, of course, he gets a down over Masato in the fight before that. He earns his way to fight Bacall. Bacall is ready to go, though. He's figured out the boxing for the time being, for that night. He's able to score a down over Sauer. Sauer does this weird thing where he's holding on to his head, and he looks at the ref for some strange reason, but it was like in the middle of the action. Sauer goes down to a shot from Bacall over the top. He's in bad shape. Bacall continues to pour on the offense, and then Bacall has this moment where he lands some clean uppercuts, and that's it. Bacall is your K1 Max winner for the second time. So these guys, you would think that they'd meet again, but they don't meet again for like some years. Not until we get what I would call the last year of K1 World Max being what it used to be. You know, like it just the best guys in the world competing under that banner. This would be the last year. Now, again, after that, Petrosian would go on to win the following year because Petrosian's in this field. But he'd go on to win the following year. But that year where Yoshihiro Sato was in there, or Mike Zambides was in there, or Gago Drago was still in there. It wasn't a bad year. That's still a solid team, but a solid unit. But Bacall was not in there. Sauer was not in there. It was a weird, weird field. We go ahead and we flash forward to that year. And in that year, Bacall and Sauer meet for the third time. And again, they're fighting without knowing it for the world championship of each other. Because these guys just, their styles create a very close, not always entertaining, very important that you guys understand that these rivalries don't mean entertaining fights all the time. And this time, this case, these matchups, only the second fight was entertaining. The first one and this one was not were not what I would call entertaining scraps. So they compete third one, they go to an extra because of their styles. And again, 2-1 in favor of Andy Sauer. They just prefer the boxing to the, you know, kicks of Bacall. Bacall would then, you know, leave the league and fight in Thai fight and, you know, go against some guys who, to call the guys bums that he went against, not bums in terms of, you know, anything to reflect their character, but compared to the competition he was used to in K1, they were such a step down. Andy Sauer went out and competed. It's showtime, kind of wherever he could compete. He makes consistent money as a kickboxer. One more thing I want to say in honor of Bacall. Bacall actually did end up in a tournament where him and Sauer could have met again. They ended up both fighting in the shootboxing tournament a couple years after that meeting. And in that meeting, Bacall did what only Sauer had done. He won the shootboxing championship. Sauer had lost because he got judo thrown twice by Toby Amada. Amada then goes on to fight Bacall. Bacall just, you know, battered him with low kicks. But that was the chance for those two to fight again. It just didn't happen. Sauer was able to win the kickboxing, but and there's nothing that they score higher than judo throws and S1 and shoot boxing. So shout out to Bukau for getting that belt and adding to his collection. Still one of the great kickboxers of all time. One of the great kickboxers of my era. Good stuff there, but 2-1 in favor of Andy Sauer. So we move on to our next rivalry, and again, this is a fun one because, again, I talked about how the forums, I said it in this podcast before, but I'm going to say it again. The forums are so important to this list because a lot of what happened in the forums with people communicating, people talking back and forth, people sharing the fights that they loved, a lot of what happened in those forums spilled over into how people perceived kickboxing. And that's why they say, oh, kickboxing is a little bit down because, you know, the forums, we didn't have Twitter back then. So people watch Twitter, they'd see that there's still a decent crowd following these major kickboxing events. But it's because the forum life was so important, you know, like friends would. I remember at one of the Amsterdam events for the K1, like 6 or 7 guys from K1 fans got together, took a picture and posted it in the forum saying that, hey, you know, we're here. And I'm like, wow, how crazy is that, that these guys have all gotten together to as friends, and they all met on the forum. One of my good friends in this life, he just had a birthday yesterday, Tom Vandershill. Tom, one of my good friends for life that I met on the fight forums. That's how big the fight forums were. We met there. And for us, John Wayne Parr was the man. He posted all the time. He replied to you. He agreed with you or disagreed with you. He posted pictures, like I said, of his family. John Wayne Parr was the man. We all love John Wayne Parr. We all still love John Wayne Parr. But back then, he was the guy. His big rivalry was one of many. But one of the first big ones was with Mike Zambides. And Mike Zambides was this Greek superstar. He came out and he's like very short, 5'2", 5'3", and he's got this KO power. He throws, you know, wide controlled hooks where he looks for his opportunities, and he's got one of the greatest highlights. If you watch Mike Zambides' highlight, I don't care who puts it together, it's awesome because he just lands big time shots over the top. He's athletic enough to land jumping knees and jumping kicks. Mike Zambides is the man. Plus, he's one of the last great kickboxers in the 10-round, 8-round, 12-round era. Now, for those of you who have no idea what I'm talking about, because that sounds crazy, when he fought, it was pretty much like, I'll say it was pretty much like boxing. The rounds were 2 minutes, but the action was, there was no clinch. Was no clinch, no elbows, no knees in the clinch, none of that existed, no knees. It was all just kickboxing, just kicks and punches. And he was one of the last great fighters of that era. So when he got signed by K1, he had the fight with Albert Krauss, and he won by the big overhand KO. And then, of course, he got in and he fought Masato. To this day, I feel like, man, he did a great job fighting Masato. And he could have won that first fight for sure. At least it could have gone to an extra. He took a down in the first round, but rounds 2 and 3 is just him landing big time shots while Masato just runs around and survives. He was the man. So we've got the kickboxing, the last kickboxing superstar of the 10-round era against John Wayne Parr, the forum favorite, and they meet the first time. This is the first big kind of epic back and forth that I was ever part of as far as being on the forums and people debating a fight, because this one happened right around the time that I fell in love with the sport. So Mike Zambides gets the win, fight gets posted, people are wondering, you know, who they feel won, kind of got back and forth, that kind of deal, whatever. John Wayne Parr, adamant that he won. We don't know what Mike Zambides felt. I'm sure he felt that he won, but I'm just saying he didn't post in the forums. So they meet again, not right away, like 5-6 years later. So that just kind of shows how the game is. They meet 5-6 years later down the road, and in the fight, John Wayne Parr definitely wins the early portions of the fight. And then I want to say round 3, round 4, I really started to give credit to Mike Zambides because he started to pour it on. Land a lot of big shots, a lot of big hooks, a lot of overhands. And then every time John Wayne Parr is down, he'll just bite down on the mouthpiece and just start throwing 1-2s. And for those who've seen it, you know, his fight with Cosmo Alexander, he did the same thing. He's just older, so it doesn't have the same pop. At this time, he's losing pop, but he's at least still trying. You know, he's like, he's losing KO pop violence and his striking, but it's just not gone all the way. Still, I thought the last two rounds were definitely in favor of Mike Zambides. If I'm remembering them correctly, it was either the last two rounds or rounds three and four. But I thought that it could have been a draw. I thought that it was close. Nevertheless, we get a win for John Wayne Parr. So we're one apiece. So then they fight again. And this is for the heavyweight championship of each other. This is for the championship of each other. These two go out there, and John Wayne Parr puts a exclamation point on their rivalry. He goes out there and blows Mike Zambides out. He gets him in trouble, drops him in the first round, and then he drops him two more times. Hands were on point. Just landed big-time offense. Zambides couldn't get back into it. He was hurt. Big-time KO win for the gunslinger, John Wayne Parr. We were so happy for him. And again, this is kind of later. Forms aren't what they used to be. They're kind of slowing down at this period of time. But how awesome was that? How awesome a victory was that? So shout out to John Wayne Parr. Mike Zambides, of course, since then, he had some big fights, some big wins. He was able to walk away from the sport after a victory over Steve Moxon. John Wayne Parr still fights here and there. He's coming off a couple, you know, he lost to Cosmo last year, and he lost on his promotion of the Cage Muay Thai with the MMA gloves. But he's still looking to compete here and there, and, you know, because he says it pays for everything. So I wish him all the best. Next fight, I'm going to talk about John Wayne Parr again. John Wayne Parr versus Yotsen Klei was a great rivalry on the rivalry series. As I mentioned before, John Wayne Parr was the forum guy, and we all loved him. And at this period of time, the story behind it is the WBC had just announced that they are moving to Muay Thai. So we're all pumped. Everybody who, it sucks now. The WBC, it didn't turn out to be what we thought it was going to be. So, like, right now, WBC, it exists as a belt out there. But in the beginning, we were expecting it to be like boxing. We were expecting it to be, K1 only had two weight classes. They had heavyweight and they had, you know, their middleweight. So we expected this would fill that gap in between. And we knew John Wayne Parr struggled with making 154. Him, Chapman, Shane Chapman, guys like that struggle with that weight. And I was like, this is their opportunity. Then all of a sudden, he takes a picture with a guy, a Thai guy, who was the 141 champion who was moving up in weight, and his name was Yotsen Klei Fairtex. Yotsen Klei. They just said Yotsen Klei. I don't think it said Fairtex. So him and John Wayne take a picture together, and I'm like, all right, cool. Yotsen Klei is going to lose. John Wayne is going to win. John Wayne's the man. He posts in the forum. We're excited for him. We're all excited for the fight. For whatever reason, this fight got on the internet really, really quick. Now, again, no Facebook really at this time. It was probably existed, but not in video form. It wasn't really posting videos and stuff at the time. But what did exist was YouTube, but YouTube wasn't what it was. Back in our day, it was all about Mega Upload or SendSpace or something where you could download. So, like, you always wanted to download video and upload video. And if you didn't do it, you were called a leecher. If you just showed up and just asked, you were called a leecher not so much if you showed up and took fights. You were called a leecher if you showed up and then asked for where are fights. That was the thing that made us say, all right, who the hell are you? But I remember when I first got on, I got called it. And then I started uploading like crazy. I was like, no, that's not me. So in the end, that was kind of what the fight forum community was all about. And this fight got up really quick. So I'm watching it. I already know the results. I know that Yotsen Klei wins. And then I see that big head kick land. It was awesome stuff. And then I see him win with that counter left hand. And then John Wayne Parr, he's still all guts. He's still going to push. And he fought well towards the end of that fight, towards the end of the round, the rounds in that fight. But it was a clear victory for Yotsen Klei Fairtex. Then comes one of the biggest events between 2000 and 2010. One of the bigger, I do not know how this didn't have success down the road, and I'll bring it up on another series that I do. But the Contender Asia comes out. Contender Asia comes out, and it, first of all, people didn't realize it was aimed at, like, teenage and, you know, young women, college-age women when it first came out. There was, the guys had a certain look. They were looking for something, but people, it was about Muay Thai, but it didn't have all the great, they didn't have all the best Muay Thai fighters, but it had a solid field. But we knew when we saw that field, there's a really good chance that John Wayne Parr and Yotsen Klei are going to meet again. Because outside of them, we had what, Askarov? He had a good chance because Askarov had fought Bukal before the show had started, if I'm remembering correctly. So we knew about Askarov. And then, of course, we knew about Norepol. He was in the same camp as Yotes and Clyde, so that one was another person that could be there at the end. I looked at that fight. I looked at those two guys, and I'm like, all right, what's this going to be down the road? I'm excited to see what these guys are going to produce. We watched the tournament. I'm telling you, weekly on the forums, everybody couldn't wait for the next episode. They broke it down. You know, they talked about Soren's victory, or they talked about whoever. It was a big deal. It was a big deal. So the show goes how we think, how we thought. Jeremy Parr meets Yotes and Clyde. Yotes and Clyde drops John Wei Parr twice in the fight. And I believe that one, I can't remember the date on it, but it was what we thought. Yotes and Clyde is your contender champion. You never think these two guys are going to fight again. But you'd be wrong. All of a sudden, I hear about this documentary for John Wei Parr. And when I hear about it, I don't know what it's going to be, what it's going to be about, you know, what's going to happen. All I know is John Wei Parr, who, of course, we had known about his past in Thailand and so on. All I know is that he is now going to go against Yotes and Clyde one more time, and there's this documentary following him. So that makes me think, all right, this is before, I'm about to go out to Thailand before this happens. But, like, that makes me think, all right, if there's a documentary following him, it's a guy he's lost to twice. Yotes and Clyde better bring his A game, or else you're going to have some, you know, we're going to wonder about the decision on this one. I go out to Thailand, and then I always visit Teddy. Teddy is the guy who runs the Fairtex Pattaya gym, and he manages Yotes and Clyde. And we're sitting there, we're talking about it. Teddy's good people, and Teddy says, hey, man, he goes, I tell Yotes and Clyde this all the time, because Yotes and Clyde's gotten a little bit lazy now. He's gotten the money from the contender show, and he's gotten money from other things, and so he's gotten his mother out of poverty, and he could open his own gym, and he just kind of comes by and trains like once a day. So he's like, I tell him all the time, yo, man, you better get in this gym, you better start training, because if you don't win by KO, you're not going to win a decision out there. So he says it bluntly. He says, that's what's going to happen. You're going to lose. So goes out there, and I talked to Yotes and Clyde. Side story, this will make you guys laugh. There was a kid there who was just training at the facility. He'd been, you know, in Thailand, like a lot of other people there, to train. And we're kicking the bag, and then Yotes and Clyde sees this kid kicking wrong. And he goes, hey, you should try to kick the bag like this. And then the kid looks a little confused, so then I repeat what I see Yotes and Clyde do. I say, hey, man, he's trying to get you to kick like this. And Yotes and Clyde's like, yeah. By the way, Yotes and Clyde's English, pretty good. Pretty good for a guy who's in Thailand. So then Yotes and Clyde then tries to correct the guy's kick again, and the guy shakes his head as if he's not going to listen to Yotes and Clyde, which he doesn't, and then he keeps doing it his own way. Somebody turned down advice from Yotes and Clyde on kicking the body. This is just it's unacceptable, but it's unbelievable at the same time. I just can't. Yotes and Clyde is the premier body kicker in the world. He put Thai kicking into the body on the map. I'm not saying that other people don't kick hard to the body. I'm not saying other Thais didn't kick hard to the body. But when Yotes and Clyde did it, he changed the culture. People are like, whatever that guy's doing to people's bodies, it sucks. So anyways, back to what I'm saying. Yotes and Clyde goes out there. In my personal opinion, I did think Yotes and Clyde won. And I actually thought he won clear. But they went ahead. The decision went against them. John Wayne Parr got the victory. I credit John Wayne Parr, no matter what you think of the decision, because John Wayne Parr lost to him twice. And John Wayne Parr still said, the standard of my career is based off of this guy. I need to fight this guy again. And he goes back in there to a guy that he lost clear to two times. And I just respect that about him. And John Wayne Parr, like I said, we all love him because he is the guy who talked to us back. He was one of the few fighters that hit the forums and stayed in communication with us. So shout out to both of those guys. Their rivalry sits in my mind for sure. Next rivalry I'm going to talk about is Stefan Leko versus Remy Bonjasky. In 2002, Stefan Leko was already one of the mainstays in K1. He had won some regional tournaments. He had won the right to go to the K1 World Grand Prix before. He was one of the better fighters in the world. And when he's introduced to me, the broadcast for America is only talking about Leko. They're not talking about this Remy Bonjasky guy. They're talking about how skilled he is, how he puts his combinations together. He's just an awesome guy to watch. And then they sort of, every once in a while, talk about this Remy Bonjasky guy. Remy Bonjasky was a guy who, on short notice, fought Ray Seffel. And he's able to beat him by low kicks. He's able to beat him by low kicks, I want to say, in the fourth round. I think they stopped it between the third and the fourth. At that time, Remy Bonjasky, and at this time, he's training three times a week. Why is he training three times a week? I think he had a job at a bank to pay his bills. And that's just pretty much what his life was. He liked the kickboxing thing. He pursued it, but he couldn't do it full. So he just went to the three times a week class that had some fighters in it, but it had, mostly had like cardio, you know, people in it. And once that happened, a friend of his was like, all right, yo, you've got to get better. Because Lekko went out there and pretty much, you know, beat him clear. Lekko was one of the better fighters in the world. That was what was supposed to happen. He had a good combination flow where Lekko would throw a stream of like six punches together, and inside that six, he'd find the way to get between or around your guard. Stefan Lekko was the man. He was awesome. So Lekko then goes, after that fight, he goes into this thing where he's like considering MMA, goes to MMA, gets paid a lot of money to go fight for Pride, gets submitted like every time he fought. It just didn't go his way. But he spent like 3 or 4 years just focusing on that. Remy Bonjasky, one of his friends says, hey, I'm going to sponsor you. I really want you to pursue this full. Remy then gets the opportunity to pursue it full, and not even right away after the Lekko fight. This happened like, you know, like a year or so later. He gets to pursue the fight full, the fight game full. He wins a qualifying tournament in America, then goes on to beat Bob Sapp, then goes on to win his first K-1 World Grand Prix. That got the legend of Remy Bonjasky started. Him becoming a legend, him getting 3 K-1 World Grand Prix, him being one of the better fighters of his era. Lekko, on the other hand, was gone. He's gone for this gap, and then he has his return. He doesn't return until, I can't remember what was his first fight in return, but I do know that 2006 was the first World Grand Prix on his return. When he made that return, he decided that he was going to, he got matched up with Remy, and then he hit Remy with a low blow real bad, and then he hit him with another one real bad. And Remy's response, laying on the ground and so on, Lekko was convinced that Remy was faking it. He was faking it. He was trying to get Remy Lekko disqualified, so he's just laying there in pain and so on. So what they decided to do in that tournament that year is they moved all the other matches ahead of those two, and then they were going to do their match again on the end of the quarterfinal round. They go out there, touch gloves. One of the first things Stefan Lekko does is he shoots the inside low kick, and it scores to Remy's groin, hits him clean, and he's apologetic, but like Remy's like, are you kidding me kind of look, falls to his knees, and Lekko is again like going crazy because he thinks that he's faking it. Remy then gets up, powers through, gets a decision, but he can't continue in the tournament. And then Lekko can't continue in the tournament, and as I mentioned earlier, Peter Arce was the one who jumped into that tournament for the company. And the next year, Remy Bonjasky goes against Lekko in the in the elimination round. Remy Bonjasky is determined to wipe out all the doubts. He had to hear for a whole year all the jokes, all the, I feel like Remy was being a chicken, I feel like he didn't want to fight me, I felt like he was being a baby. He had to hear that for a whole year. And then, all of a sudden, Lekko goes out there and Remy is trying to destroy him. He's scoring everything. Remy's all over him. Remy scores a big knee that drops Lekko. Lekko goes down. Then Lekko sits down. He kind of takes the rest of the count on the knee. And then he gets up at 8, and then the ref waits for him to, like, you know, is like looking to touch his gloves to send him back into the fight. For whatever reason, Lekko turns around and walks to the corner. Like, if you're going to do that, you got to do that during the count. You can't do that when someone gets to 8 and then turn away from the ref. It looks like you're buying more time. When he did this, the ref rightfully called the fight over with. Lekko was disappointed, and clearly he had more fight in him, so I understand him being disappointed. But I do understand what the ref was doing there. I do think the ref did his job. The most important thing for me about that whole moment was, it was an outstanding thing for Remy, who they jumped on him about like not fighting, being chicken and so on, and he got right back in there and fought who it was. He had a moment where he went in there, Remy Bonjasky in his career, he fought Jerome LeBanner in Amsterdam, and I thought the crowd was pro Jerome LeBanner. The rumor was out against Remy. Like, people always kind of thought, you know, he's a little bit of a baby, that kind of deal, whatever. They like, for example, when he went against Lecco, he took that teep to the body and he went down. And people were like, the commentary is like, I didn't think the kick was that hard. He could have been fine. He could have kept going, whatever. And then years later, everybody started getting dropped by that kick by Semi. And then people were like, okay, you know, nobody went back and said, all right, Remy took something real. That shot was for real. Instead, they kind of just labeled him that and then left it. This night in Amsterdam, he goes against Jerome LeBanner. Jerome has a good first round. Round two, round three, all of a sudden, here comes Remy. Remy comes on. He's scoring good offense down the stretch. And then the crowd that was against him in round one was for him by the end of the fight. And then he gets a decision. Jerome LeBanner and his people, they appeal the decision. They're upset. They're upset with the judging. K1 looking to bend over backwards for Jerome LeBanner. They change the decision. Remy doesn't even dispute it. They fight again in the first round of elimination tournament. Remy stops Jerome LeBanner in the third round. That mentality is what Remy has had, and he doesn't get enough credit for it. That's why I focus on that in my documentary. But in this fight with Lecco, he had taken a lot of verbal abuse. He was a baby, he was a chicken, he didn't want to fight, that kind of deal, whatever. He jumped right back in there the following year, and he fought Lecco again. And he doesn't get enough credit for doing those sorts of things. Shout out to Remy. He went on to, of course, retire, but he had a great career, and he knew when it was over with. He wanted to go give it one more shot, and he realized, hey, these guys are better, bigger, stronger, faster than me now. I can't compete like I used to. Lecco, still trying to fight, you know, towards the end of his career. I think I always wonder, one of my big what-ifs in all of kickboxing is what would have happened if Stefan Lecco had of stayed fighting instead of pursuing MMA for the 3 years that he had left. Because he was still kind of physically in his prime like that. He could have won one of the K1 World Grand Prix. He was skilled enough to do it. He wasn't a big guy, but he had the punch volume, and he could punch hard enough, you know, because the shot that he dropped Peter Arts with was pretty legit. But he just didn't, I'll never know what it could have been of his career. Going to go ahead and move on to the next fight in the rivalry series. Liam Harrison is going to go against Anawat. Anawat was the elite Thai, I think I'll say, of my era. The two elite Thais of my era, as far as full rules Muay Thai goes, was Anawat and Sanchai. Those are the guys who I say internationally, if I look at the last 15 years of me falling in love with the sport, who are the guys that people most talk about from the stadium style of fighting? Sanchai, who not only is Sanchai an exceptional fighter, he, in a matrix way, stretches the imagination. He does something that you didn't think could happen. His jumping kicks, scissor kicks, his handstand kick, his jumping inside leg kick, he stretches the imagination of, oh, you didn't think this could work? Well, it's working right now. Like, he stretches your imagination on what could happen in a fight. And then you go to Anawat, who was a guy who, skill-wise, all the stadium fighters could beat him. Like, they could beat him skill-wise. They could beat him in the clinch. They could beat him with distance striking. But he had KO pop like you hadn't seen in quite some time in the stadiums. And I look at that time and I go, he's the two-time fighter of the year. And I think it's because he could be down, but he could still KO you. He could still come back by KO. So, Anawat starts fighting international, and one of the fights happens, lo and behold, Champions versus Champions 2. Who's there? I'm there. Champions versus Champions 2 happens in Jamaica. They put together a lot of fights that people wondered what if the fights were ever able to come together, but because of the nature of the event, pretty much it was an amateur event for the whole weekend. It was an amateur charity event for the whole weekend. And there was like a golf tournament, there's all these things. So this charity event put some money aside, and they had Clifton Brown, who is from, you know, Toronto, but he's got Jamaican roots, put together a fight card. He's on the fight card. He's fighting Goglai Gunnarsson, or Koglai, for those who know that. But he puts together this fight card. On this fight card, he puts together this special fight. And this fight was I don't know how else to put it. It was pretty much a low kick fest for Anawat. Anawat comes out scoring low kicks. And I was surprised. I was like, hey, where are the hands? Where are the hands? Harrison just never seemed to get going. He stayed in the first gear the whole time. And then all of a sudden, he tried to, like, it looked like a half check. Tried to get his leg up, but it was too late. He then gets the check, kind of breaks his shin a little bit. And again, Harrison's another guy who we started to love because he started to join the forums in the, you know, 2009, 2010, around that period of time. And so he's injured and he loses that fight, and Anoa'i gets the victory. And it's a funny, you know, side story. When I was there when Liam Harrison lost to Musab Amrani at Glory, and then I was talking to Richard Smith about it, and Richard was like, Richard Smith, the coach of Bad Company and Liam's coach, he cracks a joke. He goes, "Oh, it's your fault. It's your fault. For that's the reason why we got stopped. And we haven't been stopped since the last time you were here." It was a funny joke, but that night he was stopped. Then he goes back to training hard, goes back to working hard. A promotion puts the fight together in England, and he puts together one of the better fight performances of his career. Liam Harrison, to get stopped, in the same way that I give John Wayne Parr credit, it's so hard to go back in there when it didn't go your way at all. You know, sometimes, you know, you get, it'd be different if it was a one punch and you were KO'd. But when it doesn't go your way and you just go down and you're like, all right, what do I do? I lost for three rounds and then got stopped. How do I come back from that? He mentally decided two things. One, he said these low kick things are working. I'm going to start using them. And he's been using them heavy ever since. Two, he just mentally decided that he wanted to work hard, train hard, and he wanted that opportunity again. And he beat Anoa'i in the second one. Anoa'i has finished his career, hasn't fought that I know of in quite some time. Liam Harrison is getting ready to go against Fabio Pinca later this year in one of the elite matches between international Muay Thai fighters. That should be great. So shout out to them. Next fight I'm going to talk about, Remy Bonjasky versus Alexei Ignashev. In 2000, Alexei Ignashev was in a regional tournament in Belarus. And in this tournament, he murder-death-killed three guys. That just awesome, awesome stoppages by KO. You're not going to get better stoppages than what you're going to see. Well, you can, but you're going to get quality stoppages if you watch this tournament. Ignashev pulls through these guys. 2001, Remy Bonjasky, you know, training 3 days a week, gets called in to fight Ray Seffel, who's already a veteran in the K1 brand. He had a year where he got to the finals and lost in the finals, if I'm remembering correctly. And so we've got a guy from Holland who everybody's got, hey, this guy's got a lot of tools. He can be something special down the road. And you got a guy in Ignashev who everybody thought this was the next big star. You know, like when Badr Hari came around, people were like, this is the best talent since Alexei Ignashev, because Alexei Ignashev really was that special of a talent. He was something. And the reason why these guys are on the list, they fought five times, and Remy won the last one. He won an extra round decision. None of their fights is what I would call extraordinaire. None of their fights is what I would call special. I wouldn't look at them competing and say, oh man, this is the fight you got to see. And even this last fight that they had, it wasn't special. But when they go to the press conference, Remy said something interesting. He goes, this is the fifth time we fought. I really think it should be four fights to one, but he got some bogus decision somewhere. And then Alexei heard it, and Alexei was like, nah, it's you're up 3-2. And I look at that, and I kind of laugh. But in my mind, I go, look at the trajectory of these two careers. These are the elite kickboxing heavyweights from around the year 2002 to 2000 or to 1998, between that gap. These are the best products. One product produced from Holland, one product produced from Belarus. Alexei Ignashev had every tool. He had all the coaching. He had great partners. Vitaly Akramenko was one of his training partners. He was a solid heavyweight. He's a smaller guy who moved into grew into a heavyweight body. But we had that. We had a guy who had the fights and the opportunities and the look, and they loved him in Japan. And then between alcohol, our girls, our, you know, traveling, or it just never happened for Alexei Ignashev. Side story on Alexei Ignashev, he was in a tournament in the USA, and a friend of mine was out there for the tournament. And a friend of mine, he went after he'd been gambling, he went by and he saw that Alexei Ignashev was at a slot machine. Goes up to his room, falls asleep. Next morning, gets up, goes to get some breakfast. And when he goes to get some breakfast, he sees Alexei Ignashev on fight day wearing the exact same gear at the exact same slot machine. And the moment he saw it, he ran and he put his money on Stefan Leckel. Because he was like, Lecco is going to win this tournament. Ignashoff, I'm telling you, he was gambling all night in the exact same machine. It's those kind of stories that build up. Stories about him, you know, with whatever girl, him with whatever, you know, drink or whatever, just missing. The change in his body was so clear. If you look at them, they both have lean, muscular bodies when they first start off their careers. You know, a little bit different. Alexei didn't have the ripped abs, but he still was lean. Then all of a sudden, flash forward 7 years, Remy Bojowski is winning K1 World Grand Prix. He's still ripped up, still in shape, still doing this. Alexei Ignashoff, not so much. Didn't happen. And you wonder what if. Shout out to, you know, the people who kind of spoke into his life in hopes of turning his career around, but it just didn't happen for Alexei Ignashoff. And Remy Bojowski, the other elite prospect of that time, he wins this series 3-2, but most importantly, he wins the era because he ended up being one of the great kickboxers, whereas Ignashoff is just one of the, him and now Badr Hari will join him, just one of the big head-scratchers of their era. Next fight I'm going to talk about, or the next fight series I'm going to talk about, is the rivalry between Badr Hari and Ruslan Karev. Ruslan Karev was a guy who emerged on the scene because of the K1 tryout. K1 tryout had all these guys that were like prospects from all over the world. And then Ruslan gets there and he points his record out. And the first thing you notice about his record is it's got a bunch of amateur fights in it. But he says that he's 147-5. I will remember that forever. I was like, I can't believe this guy's got 100, you know, plus fights. And most of them are amateur. And I don't know who he is because I watch kickboxing. Back then, I paid people to put a collection of fights together and send me DVDs. I still have them. Like, I look across the room, there is this CD holder that's got those fights in them right now that I don't need because it's a CD and we don't use those anymore. It's like a, you know, or it's a DVD disc. But I love the sport so much, I paid that guy $10 a video to make those fights for me. That's where I came from. And Ruslan, when I came out, I was like, I ain't seen you in none of the videos, man. So, who are you? You know, I've got videos from Russia. I don't have you. But most of his career was amateur. Then we had Badr Hari, who I mentioned to you guys before. This young, brash kid who talked the talk and came out exciting, you know, fight style and so on. These two meet in the first fight. In their first fight, Ruslan kind of rushes Hari. Hari falls on the ground. Rightfully so, he complains because Ruslan does hit him on the ground. He does kick him. He does punch him while he's on the ground. It's clear. It's clear that that happens to me. When I look at the replay, nothing about the replay makes an argument for Ruslan. It clearly happened to Hari. The problem with the video is it's clear that Hari could get up if he wants to. He can get up. They're doing the count. Hari can get up. He's not hurt. While he's sitting there and he's complaining to the refs and he's upset about the scene, he just gets counted out and he loses. And then goes one of the other great moments of the 2000s. Badr Hari goes to the back room and he goes crazy. And he keeps yelling over and over that I'm never going to fight for K1 again. And he's like breaking everything. Everything that he could see, he breaks. Exit signs broken. Posts broken. Little like signs on the side broken. Tables in the back broken. Hari goes crazy. It's one of the great moments of this. It's a great moment because it's a memorable moment. And he goes nuts. Later, they interview him. And, you know, during the interview with Stillwell, shout out to Stillwell, who also has a great Ignashoff highlight. Stillwell interviews him. And then, so look for Stillwell on Instagram. Look for him. I don't know if he's on Instagram as much, but he's for sure on YouTube. That's where he's got his videos. He posts a lot of great stuff to YouTube. And he for sure is on Twitter. But he posts this video where he does a documentary. And in the documentary, Hari just admits it. He says, and forgive me for speaking in this language, but he says, I was just being a pussy. He said, I just wanted the refs to penalize him with a point, and I was trying to pout until they did that. I was trying to lay there until they did that. And I was like, shout out to Hari for admitting that that's what happened. Then we get to fight number two. Fight number two is what makes the rivalry what it is. One of the great comebacks you're ever going to see in a fight. First, they get into kickboxing exchange. It's a pretty entertaining kickboxing match. Hari got a little wild sometimes looking for big KO shots. Ruslan's got to throw a little wild and wide because Hari's so tall. Ruslan drops Hari in the second round. Hari gets up. Refs talk to him, trying to make sure his head's clear. And the guy who stayed down the first time they met is up and ready to fight. And the moment they ring the bell for the two to exchange again, now the moment the ref says the two can keep fighting, Ruslan landed the most awesome, or excuse me, Badahari landed one of the most awesome right hands you're ever going to see in your life. This thing was awesome. It just took Ruslan out. Ruslan was out cold. Awesome right hand. Hari then went on to fight elite guys, be one of the better guys. Ruslan had mixed results, got bad KOs here and there. Then they meet again a third time. And when they met the third time, Hari said in an interview, he goes, I passed him. He said, just skill-wise, I passed him. And he was right. Hari was a different animal the next time they met, and he just blew Ruslan out. It just wasn't even close. So he won in like 40 seconds, two down, scored rather quickly. Ruslan went on to fight a few more times. I don't know what he's doing now. Hari, of course, went on to have the spectacle that is the Badahari show. But that series should be remembered because, man, that for that second fight alone, this series should be remembered. Tyrone Spong versus Nathan Carnage Corbett is the next rivalry series match that I have. The two fought twice, and again, it happened in Jamaica, and this was the fight that I most wanted to see. At the time, I was writing for World Muay Thai Magazine, and when I wrote for World Muay Thai Magazine, I wrote that this was the fight that had to happen out of all the fights. Now, World Muay Thai Magazine mainly focused on fights from people from Australia because it was an Australian magazine. But they went ahead and they gave me a little segment. They gave me a little area on that one. And when they did it, at the time, they were pushing this alligator kind of as their mascot for the team or for the magazine. And so the mascot was like playing promoter, and it was like really weird. But the biggest thing that the mascot thing was trying to say was, they wanted to fight in Holland from Tyrone's people. Nathan's people, of course, wanted to fight in Australia. So it was going to happen in a neutral ground. What better neutral ground than Champions versus Champions? And Champions versus Champions 2, I am there. If you watch video of this fight, if this camera goes towards the right at all, I'm literally touching the ring on the right side as if I was in the damn corner. I am there because it was the fight that I most wanted to see. Didn't take long for me to see the most skilled guy in this fight was Tyrone Spong. Tyrone Spong was able to score at will. Carnage couldn't get anything going for two rounds. And then Carnage is in trouble because Tyrone lands a big shot that almost scores a KO like right in front of me because he had broken his hand. So he had to rely on another hand. He had to sit on it with more power. Lands a big shot. Carnage is in trouble. Carnage comes out round three. He just needs to try something. So he comes out southpaw. He's ripping some body kicks. He's trying something, but he's still losing to Tyrone, even though Tyrone's only got one hand to use at that time. Carnage then loads up on what's probably one of the most awesome right hands that I think I've ever seen, like, live in my life. He loads up. Tyrone tries to score a knee. Again, he doesn't have his hands, so he's trying to, you know, use knees and stuff like that to really, really hurt Carnage. Carnage, who had already taken a loss in this fight because he didn't get to bring his elbows. The whole card was Muay Thai, and their fight was like modified Muay Thai as opposed to full Muay Thai. He lands a big right hand. Tyrone goes down. Somehow, Tyrone's able to stand up. I have no idea how this happened. It was as big a shot as you're ever going to see. Somehow, Tyrone's able to get up. What happens then is one of the weirder moments that I've ever witnessed in kickboxing history. The ref is supposed to call the fight over with, he's supposed to wave his hands above the defeated athlete who's lost and then escort them to their corner. That is what the protocol is if a guy is knocked out and they get up to their feet. That's what you do it. What the ref does instead is he goes over towards Tyrone's corner and he does this half sign that looks like the fight could be over with. But he doesn't do it in front of Tyrone. He leaves Tyrone, who had somehow gotten to his feet. Nathan thinks the fight's still going, and understandably so. Nathan has been losing the fight, and now he goes, this is my moment. I'm going to go in for the kill. I've gone in for the kill my whole career against guys. This is my moment to go in for the kill. So he goes in, lands some shots. Tyrone goes down. What happens in Tyrone's corner is they saw correctly that the ref was trying to stop the fight. And what's his name? Anderon. I can't think of his name. But there's a guy who's in Tyrone's corner. He's the ride-or-die guy from Holland. He's a strength and conditioning coach. He really has been there for Tyrone all of his life. I can't think of his name right now. So he gets up and he's like yelling at Tyrone. Says, "What are you doing?" Or, you know, or he's yelling at Nathan. Says, "What are you doing?" Tyrone, the fight should have been called. Nathan doesn't know why he got in there. So Nathan calls up and says, "Hey, I'll fight you," that kind of deal, whatever. And then pandemonium breaks out. Some dude from the audience is yelling. He wants to get in there and fight the Dutch guys. And Nathan's crew gets in there. And then afterwards, they're trying to explain to Nathan, you hit the guy after the fight was called. And so they decide to go with a no contest because if you ever hear a boxing match or MMA, they go, let's go to the official decision. The ref is still in control before the official decision. So when that happened, the ref called it a no contest because they didn't get to that point. In my mind, victory for Nathan Carnage Corbett. You know, big time overhand right, got him back in a fight, got him the victory. On Australia's mind, Nathan won. Magazines are showing Tyrone on the ground, Nathan standing above him. They don't even mention what happened in the actual fight. They just show that very end. So, flash forward to Glory. Glory Kickboxing is an opportunity for these guys to fight again. You ask Tyrone, Tyrone says it clear. Because I had found out later that Tyrone didn't even train for the Nathan Carnage Corbett fight. Not one time. He was kind of beefing with Lucien Corbin. That was his last fight with him. And he just didn't. I had gone out there to Holland. It's when I met him and Mo Lawal. And that's when I heard that he hadn't trained for the fight. He just thought that he had to show up and went off his skill. And he almost did. So Glory puts the fight together. And they're going to fight. Nathan, of course, super confident. I got the big shot before. This time, Tyrone is training like a madman. He's in the States. He's with a new trainer. He's with Henry Hooft. He's with the Black Zillion. So he's got people looking at him, training, making sure he's training every day. He goes out there, and he puts on a clinic, and he blows Nathan Corbett out. He scores a lot of low kicks, a lot of counter shots. Nathan never got anything going. And then he drops him with a kind of variation jab hook. And then he's backing him up to a corner, and he lands another big shot, and that's it. Nathan sort of got up, but they called it. That rivalry, it was so important that those guys fought twice because they were the elite guys of my era. They probably were better off fighting full rules Muay Thai at 86 kgs. I feel like that's Nathan's – he never got to fight full rules Muay Thai. And to his credit, he fought Tyrone in kickboxing rules when that's not his rules. But, man, those guys were the elite guys. They weren't just winning. They were stopping people. They had to fight. They ended up fighting. And so it was very important for my history of kickboxing that those two put it together. So great job, gentlemen. I'm glad you fought. Next fight on the card, our next fight in the series, is Jerome Levanner versus Mark Hunt. A lot of you are, like, super excited for people who are, like, big-time fans of this. I'm looking at the time. We're at 121 right now. I'm just going to keep rolling. Let's enjoy this. So, Jerome Levanner versus Hunt is almost no one remembers the first fight. The first fight was a ho-hum decision for Jerome Levanner. Most people remember the second fight and the third fight. The second fight was a fight where it was, you know, Jerome Levanner was probably up in the cards. And then all of a sudden, Mark Hunt backs himself into a corner and he does this kind of thing where he like calls Jerome Levanner on, like he kind of like, you know, puts his gloves together, kind of does like head movement behind it, and he calls him on. And then Jerome Levanner plays the game too. He gets behind his gloves and he starts, you know, I think he says, "Hey, you know, what's going on?" Or like, kind of, he's like, "All right, you want it? I'm here to bring it too." And I think he throws a 1-2. He fell for the trap, and Mark Hunt then puts together a barrage and he turns him. All of a sudden, Jerome Levanner's in the corner. And Mark Hunt's out there throwing heat. Mark Hunt finishes the combination with one of the most awesome, like he's already got him hurt. He finishes the combination with an awesome barrage of punches, and a ref dives in to try to save the crumpling Jerome Levanner, who goes down as the ref jumps in. The crumpling made it that much cooler, let's be honest. Because that happened, Jerome Levanner loses to Mark Hunt. Hunt then goes on to win the K-1 World Grand Prix that year. He beat the following match, he beat Stefan Leko, who he was losing to, and then he scores a down in the third, and then he goes on to fight a fatiguing, oh, I can't remember who it is off the top of my head, but he's from Brazil. I'll come to me later. But he goes on to win the K-1 World Grand Prix. Francisco Filho. He's able to beat Francisco Filho in an extra round, and that's why he wins his K-1 World Grand Prix. So after that, they fight again in Paris. And this is the fight that most people remember. They remember it more than the KO. What happens in Paris, the second round, Jerome LeBanner gets Hunt in trouble, and he scores it down very early in the round. Then Hunt gets up. Jerome LeBanner scoring effective offense. Then all of a sudden, Hunt comes back. He lands like an uppercut, gets LeBanner in trouble. Then LeBanner goes down. Then LeBanner gets up, starts to fight back. He scores like a high kick, and like Hunt kind of like tips over, and then he goes down. And then all of a sudden, you get three downs in one round. It's one of the most awesome rounds in kickboxing history. If I were to do the great rounds in kickboxing history, this one would make it. It's a top five one. It's just the one that everybody remembers. Like, it was awesome stuff. They end up stopping it in the corner, and LeBanner gets the victory. And then they fight one more time, and LeBanner wins that. So LeBanner has the series 3-1. But LeBanner, both guys kind of cracked the joke. I've heard both of them say every time they fought each other, they felt like they lost years on their lives. It's just kickboxing slugfest at its best. It's not kickboxing skill at its best, but it shows the kind of athletes and the kind of power that you see when these elite athletes go at it. So shout out to both guys, Jerome LeBanner, Mark Hunt, must see. Next series I'm going to talk about, again, only happened twice, but when it happened, it was awesome. We got Badr Hari versus Semi Schilt. The first time these two met, probably one of the great moments in the history of its showtime as far as how the crowd responded. Crowd reaction matters a lot for these moments. The way they were into it, just going nuts. First of all, Badr Hari sets the stage. Semi Schilt gets to the ring first. Badr Hari sets the stage. He's got these girls who come out, they're dancing to the introduction of the Badr Hari song. So the girls come out, they're dancing to the song, and you don't even know where Badr Hari is. You are expecting Badr Hari to come out from underneath, you know, like everybody else. Basically, the way the Amsterdam Arena was set up was people would walk in, everything was underneath, underground, and you would take a little elevator, and you'd go up, and then you'd be on the main floor where all the action took place, and you'd go to the like this little pathway, walkway, if you will, runway. You would take that to the ring, and you compete. But this time, Badr didn't come out of it. Badr came from the crowd. And when he came from the crowd erupted. Badr gets in there. It's safe to say Badr Hari didn't throw one clean technique. He threw big-time overhand shots because Badr Hari is huge. For people who haven't seen Badr Hari before, he's every bit of 6'6". He's a big, long dude. He's a huge guy. So he comes up from the ground, and he's landing big-time shots. He drops Semi Schilt. Semi Schilt's in bad shape. Crowd's going nuts the whole time. Chiavello's trying to do the commentary, and everything is just going. It's just a wild, wild. Excuse me, not Chiavello. Vinnie Shorman's trying to do the commentary. It's just a wild scene. Next thing you know, they go back at it, and Hari finishes what he started. Semi Schilt goes down, and Badr Hari wins. He wins the heavyweight. It's Showtime title. Crowd's going nuts the whole time. It really was a special scene. It can't be repeated. Like, it's if Badr Hari looks back on his career and he goes, man, you know, kickboxing didn't be what I thought it was going to be, but at least I have this. That would be the moment that he'd most look at. It was a crazy special night. Flash forward to the K1 World Grand Prix. Finalist. After beating Alistair Overeem, a fight that I'll talk about later, Badr Hari is going to meet Semi Schilt in the final. You know what his game plan is. He's going to move around, be patient, look for the opportunity, and then he's going to explode with overhands, stuff that he thinks that Semi Schilt can't block, because he's long enough to do it. But this time, he wasn't. Semi Schilt proved to be one of the greatest fighters of all time by making sure he didn't let a guy who was long enough, he knows how everybody's going to fight him. He made sure that a guy who was long enough to actually get there didn't have success. As soon as Hari missed those shots, they went back to kind of slowing down, finding range. He started putting some offense on him, including that teep to the body that dropped. It's a snap teep. The knee snaps. It goes right to your body, and it drops people. It is a horrible shot. It dropped Badr Hari as well as other offense, your K1 World Grand Prix champion. I want to say that was year 2009. But your champion was once again Semi Schilt. Awesome stuff by Semi, and it's awesome that he made sure that he got that victory back. Because if Semi had to finish his era without getting a win over Badr Hari, I think it would have ruined how people saw him. So it was important that he got that win. But the reason why this is on the list is because the crowd reaction and the buzz and the just the how people felt after Hari won and how excited they were for him to beat Semi and how Semi was up to the challenge and won that next installment. Shout out to Semi. Next fight I'm going to talk about, same thing. These two only met twice. They only met twice. But it's very, very important that people realize how important these matches were, as Bukau and Masato are the ones that I'm going to talk about in the rivalry series next. Goes like this. Basically, you've got Masato is the it guy. He comes out there. He was crying because he failed to win the first K-1 World Grand Prix. The tournament was put together for him. He fails to win it. He loses to Albert Krauss. Albert Krauss goes on to win it. Next year, and one of the best same-side counter shots you're ever going to see, he throws the punch. He punches. After he takes a punch and he delivers a punch, he lands a bodacious shot that drops Albert Krauss and one of the more historical punches in kickboxing history. And he is your K-1 World Grand Prix champion because of that. So he goes into the next year. We're thinking more of the same. More of Masato winning it. Everybody had Masato as the guy to watch. Everybody had Masato as the guy who's going to win this thing again. Masato goes out there. Everything's going according to script. Wins his first two fights. You know, he won his second fight by KO, if I remember correctly. Gets to the final. Who does he meet? A different guy. A guy who no one expected. Bukau Porpamuk at the time. Bukau, who had won an extra round against John Wayne Parr. He won an extra round decision. Who knows what Bukau's career had been if he had lost that fight. Because they weren't too fond of using the same guys from Thailand over and over. But there's something about Bukau. He's got an it factor about it. Nevertheless, he's fighting John Wayne Parr. They go to an extra round. He wins the extra round, one of the rare times that they choose kicks over punches. So he wins that extra round. I truly believe, I don't know where his career would be had he lost that fight to John Wayne Parr. I think there's a really good chance that, like Yotsen Klei, they would have only used him just the one time. You know, he beat Jordan Tai to get the opportunity, and then he got in the tournament, he lost the first round. If he had lost that, the K-1 brand was the thing that helped him make his name. So who knows? But he gets the win, goes against Kohei Uramaki in the second fight. Very weird moment where he's scoring effective offense. Kohei Uramaki gets a hold of the leg and sweeps Bukau, drops him on the ground, and then kicks him one extra time. Kohei Uramaki was known for doing that his whole career. Bukau gets up, and we crack the joke. We call it pissed off Bukau. Then Bukau puts on what is a murder job on Kohei Uramaki and just starts dropping him. He's sweeping him left and right. He's low kicking him, and then in the second round he puts him away with knees. And you could just see when the fight is out of Kohei Uramaki, it's out. So then this guy Bukau goes against Masato, and he beats the brakes off of Masato. Like, it's not close. He wins every single round, and you can see that the promotion wants Masato to win the next fight. And the reason why it feels that way is because somehow they go to an extra round after Masato is just getting decimated. So he gets one more round to get decimated. This wasn't close. He was getting beat up. There was nothing that Masato did in his offense that would make anyone think that he had a chance of winning that first fight. And, I mean, afterwards he's peeing blood, and it's like as bad as it could possibly get for Masato. And made worse by the fact that the promotions threw him back out there for one more round. Bukau then becomes that champion. Bukau, Sauer wins it the next year, as we talked about, and then Bukau wins it the year after that, and takes a little bit for Masato to get that opportunity, but he is all about beating Bukau. So the tournament format changes. It's a four-fight tournament, a four-fighter tournament on the finals, and in that final, Masato is going to go against Bukau in the first round. His whole goal, he said, my only goal is to beat Bukau. It's important to him to do it because you could make the argument that, oh, you know, he fought some fights before, but Bukau fought more. Bukau fought more rounds, you know, before those two had gotten together. The thing that really kills Masato, as he looked back on it, was I was embarrassed. I was just slaughtered. I think I can do better with this guy. They go out there, and my personal opinion, I had to draw after three rounds, but the biggest key was he scored a punch as Bukau was throwing a low kick. Bukau fell on his butt. They called it a down. So then that's 10-8 round there. And then they, I think somebody called another round 10-10, and that's how he was able to do it. And then they gave one round to Bukau, and that's why Bukau wasn't able to come back. Masato getting that victory, he then went on to get, you know, he took so many low kicks in the fight, he went on to lose by stoppage to Andy Sauer in the next round, and the final round. But it was important to Masato that when I look back at my career, I've got a victory over this guy. That is huge. That is, I gotta have that. So shout out to him for, you know, that was scheduled for him taking it serious, for him taking it the same way Remy Bunjowski took his fight with Ernesto Hoost. He said, I don't know if I'm going to win the tournament, but I'm going to beat Ernesto Hoost. My whole goal is to beat one guy. Bukau experienced the same thing when Masato said, I don't know if I'm going to win this tournament, but I'm going to beat Bukau. Awesome stuff, and history is important that he has that. Next fight we're going to talk about is Badr Hari versus Alistair Overeem. This is important because, of course, Alistair Overeem having a lot of success in mixed martial arts right now, but he came from mixed martial arts, and he got into the tournament field. Basically, this was a dynamite show that took place over New Year's Eve, and it got started by Hari saying that everybody in MMA is a bunch of gays, and nobody likes to see guys lay around with each other, and if you want some real fighting, you should do some kickboxing. Overeem, up to the challenge. Overeem then goes out there. He plays with same side. He does a knee to punch counter that he plays with to get people in trouble. And he had a good counter hook, and he blows Hari out in the first round. Hari had some offense before it, but it was still a clear win for Overeem. Overeem gets the KO, MMA people stand up. Then later, Overeem is fighting people still. He goes against Remy Bondowski. Remy Bondowski beats him in a single fight. And then he gets into the tournament later that year. He gets into the tournament because they said that there was like some sort of voting. And then he got in because of the voting. It was something stupid. It doesn't make any sense. Anyways, he got into the tournament field. So he's in the final eight. The thing that makes this moment special is the press conference. The press conference goes, and Remy Bondowski said, please, please, somebody up here has got to beat Overeem. We can't be disgraced by this MMA guy coming into kickboxing and then winning our championship. Now, again, he didn't have to go through a regional tournament. He didn't have to win European title, European Grand Prix. You know, he just had to win an elimination fight and then a tournament. So he had about as easy a route as you could possibly get. They loved him because of his body, because he's super ripped up. It was just an interesting fight card and interesting moment to have him there. So that's what Remy says. And then Overeem comes up there, and then he says that, well, you know, I already took out one of your guys in a challenge. I beat him in his hometown, or I beat him in his own sport. None of you guys could beat me in MMA. I'm going to go ahead and win the K1 World Grand Prix. And then all of a sudden, Hari goes up there, and he says, hey, I guarantee you, if we fight, I'm going to win by KO. And then it just, the back and forth, I'm telling you, it was just thick. Like, it was a great press conference. I wish I was there live. Anyways, flash forward to fight event. Overeem wins. Hari wins his fight in the first round. Overeem wins his fight in the first round. So they meet in the semis. When they meet in the semis, it's just they're waiting. And then all of a sudden, Hari explodes with some offense. Overeem doesn't really throw anything. And then they get into an exchange. Overeem goes down. Hari lands a right hand. As he goes down, the commentary done by Mike Chavello's just going crazy. And then they get back into another exchange. High kick lands. Overeem kind of falls into the turnbuckle, into the, you know, the corner. And then the ref called the fight over with two downs in a tournament and fights over with. TKO winner, Badr Hari. Not only was it cool to hear the crowd go nuts at Hari winning the fight, but Mike Chavello was part of this moment because he is going insane crazy for this KO. It's just one of the coolest things that he's ever seen in his life. I was laughing at how cool how much he was into it. So big, you know, shout out there for Mike Chavello being part of the moment, and the way that Vinny Shorman was part of the Hari versus Shilt moment. Very much Hari winning here was made better by Mike Chavello on the commentary. The other guys, of course, were excited too. Kogan was there. Mike Kogan was there, and then Ray Seppel was there. But nothing was cooler than Chavello going crazy. It was a fun evening. So that 1-1 is how that series ended. So shout out to those guys. I'm going to go ahead and move on to my next rivalry series. I got four left. Peter Arts versus Mike Bernardo. These guys fought six times. Damn, six times. And the series ends 3-3. When they first fought, Bernardo actually won the first one. But the series then takes the most interesting turn because when he wins it, Arts then wins the second one, if I'm remembering correctly. And then Bernardo goes on to win. Let me see. I'm trying to remember. No, I got it. I remember it now. Arts wins the first one. And he wins the first one. And then Bernardo, in the third round, one of the biggest shots you're ever going to see. He gets the third round of that fight, first round of that tournament. He unleashes some hooks, and he scores one of the most, the hardest shots I think I've ever seen a human being take. Arts goes down. Bernardo wins. Bernardo talks about that fight all the time. A little documentary that they did on him. He says, when I beat Peter Arts, I felt like I'd won the K-1 World Grand Prix. I felt like he was that important of a win. I felt like he was that important of a figure. It meant everything. He then went on to win the next fight by a legal groin strike. And then he won the, I think he got a decision or another KO in the third fight. And then here comes Peter Arts. Peter Arts stops Bernardo a couple of times, and then he wins a decision. But the reason why I bring this tournament up, number one, are these two, this rivalry up? Number one, six times. Six times is a lot of times to be fighting a dude. As I mentioned before, the analogy used by Sam Greco is great. It's like tennis. You're just used to seeing the same people at the top in all of the tournaments. Great job by Mike Bernardo getting the first KO victory, and great job by Art saying, I've beaten this guy before. Let me shore up my defense, keep going to work. He's still, all the offense is still available. I can still beat this guy. It's just one of those, I mean, go ahead, look at some of these fights. When you see the shot that when Bernardo first gets his victory, when you see the punch that lands, it's just, it's one of the hardest shots I've ever seen land on a human being. Like, Art is sitting there like he's in this weird motion where he's, like, still trying to protect his head after he's already on the ground. Like, because it's that much of a concussion-type shot. Big-time shot. Bernardo, of course, you know, Art's still trying to keep the career going a little bit. He takes fights here and there. I thought he'd retire, but then he fought MMA recently. Bernardo, of course, we lost Bernardo. He took his life, but this was quite the series, and the fact that they fought six times lets you know. Another series that I want to talk about, Bruce Preacher McPhee versus Jeremy Parr. They fought three times. Jeremy Parr, first time they fought, stops Preacher. Stops him. It's good stuff. They had a good, entertaining. Preacher had some moments where he was scoring. Preacher actually has more fights than Jeremy Parr. He's got the dyed, you know, his hair was dyed purple and green are the two colors that I've seen him dyed at, but I look back and I go, man, this guy really did try to not only win, because he's got more wins. I think, if I remember correctly, I believe Preacher has more wins than anybody in the history of Australia. I think he has more total victories. I mean, 150-something, I wouldn't doubt that. So, but the guy that everybody knew was John Wayne Parr. He was still the superstar. So when Preacher had the first fight with him, got stopped with the hands in the fourth round, I want to say, John Wayne Parr was just considered the superior. Then they met again down the road. And in that fight, John Wayne Parr, if I'm remembering correctly, I think it was before the Contender Asia. I'm not 100% sure. But like, they fought again. When they fought again, the Preacher made it to a decision, but he was dropped a couple times in the fight. John Wayne Parr just proceeded to be the superior. Then something happened to let me know just how crazy that rivalry had gotten. We get to the Contender Asia, and they're picking teams. And John Wayne Parr picks Soren Mongkongtong. He's another guy from the Australian area, or from Australia, and he fought a lot of times in Thailand. And after Soren gets picked, the camera goes over to Preacher, and Preacher just like rolls his eyes like you would pick Soren over me. It's just awesome. It's just awesome. But it let me know, just in that brief moment, that there really was some wall between those two guys. Adding to the wall was John Wei Parr. Then, I'll save that story to the end. John Wei Parr then finished with the show. These guys meet for a third time. And In my mind, when I see it scheduled, I'm like, oh, Dominic Potter's going to win again. No, not the case. Preacher won probably the most important fight of his career. I think he didn't want to stop doing this thing knowing that Dominic Potter bested him every single time. He was able to put together an awesome offensive fight, and he's able to get a victory over Dominic Potter. Preacher loses the series 2-1, but in the way that Masato needed to have a victory over Macau, even if it he had to try it, and the way that John Wayne Parr needed to have a victory over Yotsuklai, Preacher needed to have a victory over John Wayne Parr. He gets that victory. On a side note, John Wayne Parr was brought out to George St. Pierre to help him prepare for my fighter, Johnny Hendricks. And when it happened, I got a message from Preacher's people and Preacher. And they're pretty much saying, oh, we fought John Wayne Parr 3 times. We would love to come out and help Johnny to prepare for how we think Dominic Potter is going to prepare GSP. So I sent a kind message back to him. I said, hey, thank you very much for the offer, but we know we're fighting George. We feel confident in our ability to score offense on him and so on. But in my mind, it just kind of hit me as I'm sending the message. I go, things got so bad between them that Dominic Potter came out to help a fighter. So Preacher wanted to come out to help the fighter that was going against Dominic Potter's fighter. It just so crazy that they had gotten to that level. But I have fun with it. We got 2 more fights. I'll go ahead and do them. And Masato Sauer is going to be... I'll do Bukao Yoshihiro Sato last. Masato Sauer. Basically, we've got Masato, who, of course, is the all-everything guy in kickboxing for you know, Japan. I've mentioned it before. We've got Andy Sauer, who was a shootboxing champion, who they kept using for shootboxing. So while he's winning K-1 Grand Grand Prix and competing in K-1, he's also competing in shootboxing and winning. I get these guys, and they meet the first time. First time they meet is in the second round of a tournament. Sauer scores like a jumping knee, and then he put a barrage of offense behind him. Masato goes down. Masato takes a knee. Andy Sauer gets a decision thanks to that down. And he moves on to lose to Bukao in the next round of that tournament. Then, the 4-man tournament that I mentioned before, the first time they went to 4-man tournament, if I'm remembering correctly, Masato fights Bukao. Andy Sauer is in the other bracket, and Andy Sauer watches as Bukao scores a lot of low kicks. So he says, okay, when I fight Masato, I'm going to score a lot of low kicks to see if I could take advantage of what happened already. Masato was, his leg was nothing. His leg was in so bad shape after the second round that they got into the clinch, and he got into the clinch to save himself. And I think Andy Sauer just did this like little baby knee from like the side position, like just kind of like a little knee, just kind of to see what it would do. The knee hurt him from the clinch. I mean, he didn't even generate a lot of power. It's not like he really hiked his leg up high. He just like, kind of turned his knee over and hit him. And I watched Masato just kind of buckle in pain and go over towards the ropes. Masato cannot answer the bell, and he gets stopped. Masato's only been stopped by three times. He's been stopped by Andy Sauer. He's been stopped by Kohei Maki. And he's been stopped by Tsuruya Sora Planchet. I wrote his name down just because I knew I was going to... I remember the Tsuruya fight. I just couldn't remember the last name. But those are the three guys who... Actually, I don't think Tsuruya stopped him. Changed that. Tsuruya just kind of dominated the fight. I don't think he stopped him. So... stopped by 2 guys. Andy Sauer is one of them. He revenged the other one. How would he revenge the Sauer one? He actually got lucky in revenging the Sauer one. He was originally supposed to fight Georgia Petrosian in a 5-round fight. He had taken the whole year off. He's going to fight one more time for K1 at New Year's Eve, the Dynamite show. And on that show, he was going to go against the champion. Of course, we all know Georgia Petrosian's got those soft hands, and his hands broke again. His hands have probably broken like 7 or 8 times over my time of being a fan of Georgia Petrosian. So his hand breaks after that event, so then he gets Andy Sauer, and Andy Sauer is game because he really wanted that fight. Masato, they both go out there, and they put on an even kickboxing match until the fourth round, Masato lands a big shot that drops Andy Sauer. Sauer's fine, but the shot scored the damage and got him 10-8 on the cards. Sauer got up and won the rest of the round. He won the rest of the round to the tone of Masato winning the rest of the round of Kashinko after he was dropped there. But the decision was already made. We knew once he fell down that was a 10-8 round. That victory meant Masato, who didn't fight again until this exhibition, that meant that Masato, between the acting money, between the advertising, between the kickboxing money, one of the few people in this sport that got to walk away with this sport with money financially secure. But I got to give a shout out to Misato for once again, in the way as I mentioned before, with Preacher, and the way that I mentioned before, with John Wayne Parr and Yosin Clive, you just can't finish your career knowing that that guy's got a W on you. And he was fortunate because he never fought for Trojan, but he was fortunate that he got the opportunity to fight Andy Sauer, because that could have been Makau in that spot. He could have fought Makau again, and they would have just been fighting for the championship of each other. He got the guy who got two W's over him, and he got an opportunity to compete with him, and he got a W there. It's a big series because Sauer had the W's over him, and he was able to get that win before he rode off into the sunset. So shout out to Misato, shout out to Sauer, who of course is still fighting. Excuse me, got something stuck in my throat. Last fight I'm going to talk about, Makau versus Yoshihiro Sato. It's one of the most interesting of the fights that I'm going to break down. First of all, the first time these guys meet, it's in the 2004 K1 World Grand Prix, as I mentioned to you guys before. Makau fought Yoshihiro Sato in the first round of that. I could have the years wrong. I think it's 2004. But Yoshihiro Sato was the first round opponent. Makau was able to beat him with a lot of 1-2s and 3-2s. He dropped him, got him in trouble, KO'd him in the second round. But again, he just kind of wasn't, his hips weren't the most technical, his knees weren't the most technical, but he believed in his offense in that moment, and he threw big time shots, and he dropped Yoshihiro Sato, and he dropped him again, so he stopped him in the first round. That's his first time fighting Yoshihiro Sato. Stops him. Second time they fight, closer fight. I still had Makau winning, but there were a lot of body kicks in there. They look for the boxing more. They go into a third round, or to an extra round. In the extra round, the fourth round, Makau scoring a lot of effective offense. He's really scoring with kicks and low kicks and everything all over the place. And after dominating the round, in the last 10 seconds of the round, Yoshihiro Sato loads up on a shot and boom, he lands a big punch. Punch doesn't drop Makau, but it was a big shot. Go to the scoring cards. One of them gave, you know, Yoshihiro Sato credit for the big shot, saying that that should be the most significant moment in the round, hurt the other guy. I'm going to give the victory to Yoshihiro Sato. The other two clearly went to Makau because Makau dominated the round before that punch. Like, he clearly landed more before that shot. Fight number three, the most interesting of them all. It's close. Then all of a sudden, third round, Yoshihiro Sato scores something and Makau's a little bit hurt. Then Makau goes down and stays down. We get a KO victory for Yoshihiro Sato over Makau. To this day, there is controversy over whether Makau took a dive for poor Pramukh, maybe had some bets. To this day, there is controversy over what shot caused him to be in that much trouble. All I know is Yoshihiro Sato got a KO victory, and nobody saw it coming. It was a big time moment in kickboxing, because Makau had never been stopped before in all of his fights, like 300 or whatever fights. So he got that victory. So our series is 2-1. These guys then fight again in Max Muay Thai. Makau's back to beating the brakes off of Yoshihiro Sato. He wins a clear one-sided decision where he pretty much dominated it from start to finish. But the reason why I bring this series up, and the last series that I'm going to bring up, is it was very important to me for people to realize how big that moment was when Sato dropped him, and how big that moment was when Sato had that one punch at the end of that extension round. People were like, hey, it shouldn't have been enough to win him the round, but at least he showed that he's capable of throwing something that could hurt Makau. And Makau fought through that, you know, that punch and got that victory. Makau seems to be the more skilled of the two, but look at their series. KO for Makau, decision in an extra round for Makau, KO for Yoshihiro Sato, decision in regular time for Makau. That's what a series should be. KO wins for both guys? Are you kidding me? How rare is that, you know, that there'd be a series long enough for both guys to get a KO off of each other? So, shout out to both guys. Super excited. Thank you for listening to this. It's a longer episode. It is. And I know that people, I usually stay around that hour mark. I really feel that that's good. But I just had this for the summer series. I was like, I'm just going to go ahead and go a little bit long in the first one. I'm grateful for everybody who stayed and listened. I really enjoy doing this. I love talking kickboxing. So this was a blast. This is, as I said before, the first time I recorded this, I got an hour and 10 minutes in, and there was a glitch or something, and I wasn't able to get the coverage. I wasn't able to get back. Basically, what happened was I had my laptop, and I didn't have it plugged in. The power went out, so I just thought that it would stop and restart where it was. Wrong. it had to go all the way over from the beginning, which sucked. I had to do it over. But as I did it again, I realized I love talking kickboxing. I love talking about, you know, some of the great Muay Thai events. So I will be back. I've got other things like the series. I go ahead and give you guys a little rundown of what to expect. I've got stuff like the biggest upset. I got that. I've got the most anticipated kickboxing matches. Stuff like that. Like things for you guys to be excited about for my summer series. I think I'm going to do 5, maybe 6 in total. Thank you so much for listening to this podcast. I hope you enjoyed it. Share it. Send it to your friends. Tell them about my podcast. I want you guys to fall in love with kickboxing as much as possible. So thank you. And for those who are wondering, you know, I'm a big fan of the women's game. The women, I couldn't find a good rivalry. They did. There's not a lot of rematches. There's not a lot of times where people fight 3 or 4 times. So I wasn't able to find anything for them to slide in here. So thank you very much, though, for all of your, you know, views and for following the podcast and for all your kind words. God bless everybody and have a good one. Peace.